the nonprofit bill that the chair is authoring. Mr. Schroeder, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
We have one quick statement from Ms. Roberts.
Oh, Ms. Roberts, before we get started, excuse me.
Mr. Chair, members, Mr. Jordahl just asked me to comment on the presentation of the constitutional offices and their budget request, which differs a little bit from the state agencies. Because of the separation of power, the governor respects the right of the constitutional offices and also of the legislature to present their own budget request to the legislature. And the governor traditionally does not comment on any of the specific initiatives that the constitutional offices bring forward. However, the governor is required by law to present a balanced budget proposal to the legislature, and therefore the governor does have specific spending level recommendations for each office. And so you'll see, not so much with the governor's office itself, but when we get to the other constitutional offices, that you'll have both a spending level recommendation from the governor and a specific request from the constitutional office itself. And I think in all cases those will differ.
Thank you. Any questions on that from members? I guess we'll take them as they go. Mr. Schroeder is the Deputy Chief of Staff. Good morning. If you'd introduce yourself and your position and proceed with your overview.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bob Schroeder. I'm Deputy Chief of Staff for Governor Pawlenty. Joining me today is Paula Brown, who's our Operations Director, and also John Pemble is in the audience with us. John is the Director of Administrative Services for our office as well. Thank you for the opportunity to give you an overview of the governor's budget, governor's office budget. As a backdrop, let me lay out for you some of the core functions of our office, many of which you may have an understanding of already. Of course, the governor represents the interests and reports to 5 million people in the state of Minnesota. We manage and coordinate the activities of 24 cabinet-level executive departments that employ approximately 48,000 individuals. We develop the state budget, each biennium, approximately $30 billion in the upcoming biennium, and general fund dollars, in total of $50 billion in all funds, and adjust them as necessary. We appoint approximately 1,000 citizens to 120 boards and commissions. This includes appointing judges to the 10 judicial districts and the higher courts. Just in the last 2 years, the governor has appointed 17 individuals to judgeships, including the Court of Appeals. And we also, of course, the Supreme Court as well. The governor consults and maintains relationships with 201 legislators and their staff. This includes monitoring and tracking and acting on the 6,400 bills that are introduced, roughly, and signing into law over 300 pieces of legislation in the last 2 years. Over the last 2 years, we've responded to over 125,000 public inquiries that we received through mail and email. The governor chairs the State Executive Council, the State Board of Investment, the Land Exchange Board, the Legislative Advisory Committee, Commission. He also is vice chair of the National Governors Association Education and Workforce Committee, vice chair of the Midwest Governors Association, and chair of the Governors Ethanol Coalition, so he has responsibilities on a national basis as well. In the last 2 years, we've issued approximately 4,500 executive orders, extraditions, proclamations, certificates, commendations, and writs of special election. We represent the people of Minnesota on national issues that are important to our state. We communicate with those folks through a variety of mechanisms, using the media, the governor's radio show on Friday, and visits that he routinely makes throughout the state. Let me just tell you a little bit about how our office is organized. The governor's office currently has 45 full-time employees, three additional are for session only, something that the legislature is familiar with. We find it helpful to us. We're organized into three program areas that's overseen by the Chief of Staff. The areas include Legislative and Cabinet Affairs, which manages the governor's policy and budget agendas with the legislature. We have a Communications and Citizen Outreach section that maintains direct contact with individual citizens and indirectly through the media. And we have an Operations section that handles our budgetary, administrative, and technical support of the office and oversight of the governor's residence. In your budget notebooks, you'll note that we proposed to the legislature for the 05-06 biennium a budget of $6,993,000 to carry out the duties and functions that I've just described. This represents a reduction of $179,000 from the current biennial budget. In order to judge this budget, we just offer for your consideration that in the 02-03 biennium, the governor's office at that time was $9,315,000. And for the next biennium, our budget reduction is approximately 25% from that high watermark. Also, during that administration, there were 55 employees. We expect our total FTE to be about approximately 40 during this upcoming biennium. It's also important to note, as I mentioned, that we do employ temporary employees and session-only staff, as I said, just as the legislature does. Likewise, we also coordinate the activities of the Federal Affairs Office in Washington, which has two staff. The purpose of this office is to serve, to represent the interests of Minnesota's state government in its dealings with federal agencies, the White House, and Congress. This includes advocating for Minnesota's funding and policy priorities, monitoring legislation, and regulations. Oftentimes, a question will be asked, how do we deal with the with our budget, the reduction that we have proposed? We are considering at the moment, though we have not made any final decisions, that we would deal with this by reducing or eliminating our contribution to the National Governors Association and considering some staff reductions as necessary. I think it's fair to say that the decisions will not be easy ones, but I think they're appropriate given the budgetary situation that we deal with. Mr. Chairman, that basically gives an overview of our office, and I'm prepared to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Schroeder. Members, do we have questions of Mr. Schroeder on the governor's budget? Representative Solberg.
Mr. Schroeder, Mr. Chair, how much are the dues to the National Governors Association?
Mr. Schroeder.
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, approximately $120,000 a year for the buy-in and $240,000. This past biennium, we did not pay our full dues. We were able to scrape together about $60,000 from our office, which we were able to pay.
So for the biennium, it's $240,000?
Yes.
But you're only cutting $179,000?
We would eliminate the $60,000 that we had paid before and then make up the difference through other changes in our office.
So the governor wouldn't even be a member of the National Governors Association?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, I think the governor, as the governor, is considered a member. Our contribution is the issue, I think.
Representative Solberg. That seems a little strange. Trying to be a member, but if you don't contribute, will the governor attend the meetings?
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, we haven't made a determination as to how we would approach that.
Well, I would think that would be something that you would consider. I mean, if you're going to eliminate all dues to the National Governors Association, has the governor or some staff been involved with the staff of that organization to see if the governor would be invited?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, we haven't made a final decision yet, so we have not yet inquired from NGA as to how they would respond or react. I mean, I think it's fair to say that they were anxious for us to make any contribution we could this past biennium. They were very generous and understanding when we were able to put together what was far less than our dues. I think it's frankly something we'd continue to have to negotiate with them on. But I wish I could tell you that what the net impact would be and how we would interact, but I just don't know at this point.
Well, Mr. Chairman, what if they say no?
I'm sorry, Representative.
What if they say no? That, you know, that you have to contribute something.
Then we'll consider that and try and make some adjustments if there's need be.
And Mr. Chair, I'd like to know then where those adjustments may come.
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, I won't be able to give you specifics as to what those changes would be, but undoubtedly, since most of our office is funded, the funding for which is for salaries and benefits for our employees, we'd have to make some adjustments in our staffing level.
Mr. Schroeder, do you have an idea as we move closer toward marking up the omnibus bill, what might face the budget slicer if you're given what you're requesting here, which is less than you had last year?
Mr. Chairman, no, I can't say with any specificity. You know, as in any organization, we have individuals that come to work for us and leave. We've been able to manage those departures in a way that's allowed us to have some salary savings to address the current budget challenges that we faced. And I expect that we will try and be diligent about doing it in the same manner in the future. But I don't think I don't think I could give you any specificity about specific positions in specific areas. I frankly don't know what the future holds or would it be fair for those employees to lay out for them that possibility.
Mr. Schroeder, I was a little surprised to see there is a special revenue account under the governor's jurisdiction. What, just give us a brief idea of what, where does that money come from? And it says it's collected from 11 agencies that want to maintain the Washington Office of Federal Affairs. So do we have agencies that monitor like transportation issues, and so they kick in a little bit and so forth?
Mr. Chair, that's very close to what we've done. In the last budget go-round, it had been our intention to close our Washington, D.C. office. This is an office that has been in, maintained by governors going back for quite some time. There are at least 30 states and territories in the country that do maintain some presence in Washington, and Minnesota has not been alone in that. But under the budget circumstances that we faced last session, budget cycle, we elected to close the office. After the budget was passed, we were petitioned pretty strongly by a number of our agencies who asked us to strongly consider coordinating on their behalf, maintaining that office. So as a consequence of their interest, we did, in fact, do that. We've got interagency agreements between 11 different agencies, each of which contribute based on a formula of, based on how much federal dollars they get. So there are some of our major agencies, public safety, Department of Transportation, Human Services. Aid spends comes from the federal government, approximately $12 billion, I think, on a biannual basis. So it was our plan at that time to close the office, petitioned by the our agencies to maintain a presence there, which we elected to do so through those interagency agreements, and thus the creation of that special revenue account.
Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chair, since we now have a special revenue fund of $522,000, before that, in previous governors, that was just part of the governor's budget. Is that correct, the general appropriation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, that's correct.
So it really isn't a cut. It's just a cut to somebody else pays the bill, and still an expenditure. But I guess I would like to know from which agencies that comes. Is it a lot of it from transportation? If it's transportation, then we could probably build some roads, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Schroeder, you have an idea of which agencies?
Yes,
according
sir.
To the budget booklet, it says that there's, I believe, 11.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Solberg. Human Services, Transportation, Education, Employment and Economic Development, Metropolitan Council, Department of Health, Housing Finance, Commerce, Public Safety, Pollution Control Agency, and Agriculture are all agencies that we have interagency agreements with. And the amount that each of those agencies contributes, again, is based on the amount of federal dollars that we receive.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Solberg.
First of all, I support you having the office there. I think it's extremely important. I don't know if I necessarily support the roundabout funding for it. I think you should be up front and say we're going to fund it. I mean, it comes from somebody anyway. But I guess I would like to see the list of those 11 and the amount that they contribute.
Mr. Schroeder, can you get that information for us?
Of course.
In writing?
Chairman,
thank you.
Solberg, be happy to.
Do we have any further questions on special revenue funds or staffing, FTE, whatever? My understanding, Mr. Schroeder, is that the governor's office is funded almost entirely by general fund expenditures, and you don't see any change in that other than what's been done for the Washington office, correct?
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Members, any more questions? Okay, thank you for coming in. If you could get that information to us in writing sometime, Representative Solberg, when would we like to have that by?
Well, there's not very much information, Mr. Chairman.
Try to get that to us.
Look at any of the agencies.
Shouldn't be too hard to get that to us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Attorney General, good morning. Thank you for coming over. Members, next we're going to have the Attorney General's office budget. Overview of his office and initiatives and all that. Good morning, and if you would introduce yourselves for the record. And, actually, members, in the budget booklet, the Attorney General's is before the governor's. And you'd have to turn back to... he's got different divisions in here listed. So good morning, if you would introduce yourself.
Okay.
and proceed.
Okay. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Mike Hatch. I'm Attorney General. And with me is Rebecca Spartz, who's the Director of Administration. And I'm not sure which page you're referring to, but essentially the easiest perspective on the Attorney General's budget is that it's basically staff. 80% of the office is staff. It is another 7%, roughly, give or take, is leases, and the rest of it's paper, computers, photocopiers, paper clips, you name it. But it's a pretty simple, in terms of its structure, in terms of the allocation, how it's allocated. The office has gone through a series of, that's the only thing that's simple about the budget. We'll get into some more complicated things in a minute. In terms of the staff, which is 80%, it did reach a high in 1998, I believe, of 520 staff. Today it is at 350. We're 50% larger 6 years ago than we are today. I think at that time there were 250 lawyers out of the staff. Today, roughly 165. I think it used to be the largest public law office. Now it's, I think, number two or three. The budget itself is not the easiest in terms of explaining where the money comes from. You'll see, I'm not quite sure which page you're looking at, but roughly $23 million comes from the general fund, but then there are a series of special allotments. There is, let's see here, we've got the health boards will pay a set amount of money. There's some money coming out of an environmental fund, very small, $50 million. There is some federal money that comes in, I believe, where's that number? Roughly $1.3 million. And then there's a series of there's money coming in from agencies. Some agencies are on what's called a partnership arrangement. They essentially establish the budget for the lawyers that they want to utilize. And I believe the total on that is approximately $5.5 million. What's the total on you? How does this work? Okay. Okay, you take the 5.5 at the top and add it to the 3.6 at the bottom, so it adds up to be about $9.1 million. And why it's divided between the two, I can't tell you, but it's always been that way. And we've gone through every year there's always a debate as to whether we use whether we should be using partnership agreements or not. I'm not a big fan of them, but I've given up. I've lost that fight, and it doesn't matter anymore. We haven't made a budget request. Let me go to that. I think it's roughly $800,000 in an add-on. We recognize that we're not in the greatest budget times, but I just want to bring these issues up because they are important. One is on civil commitments. We're doing approximately, as a state, about 75 commitments a year today. In the 90s, we were clipping along at about 25 to 30 commitments per year. It dropped from 2000 to 2004 down to approximately a half dozen per year. Since the murder of Dushadin, offenders have been offenders up for release have been sent out to county attorneys. We've set up a schedule with them where we've retained some psychologists that they pay for to interview these people or at least review the records and make a determination as to whether they should be candidates for a commitment. Last year we did 75 total in this state. I believe our office did about 45 of them. It's a big uptick. One of our concerns is we believed until the last week or two that we assumed that a lot of that was catch up from the from the people that weren't referred from 2000 to 2004. I've been talking with the attorneys, however, and they have some concern because it seems that the clip is still going on. It's not going down. And we don't have an explanation for that, but it does mean there's a lot more commitments going on. Yeah, with meth cases, meth is way up in the state. We do assist rural county attorneys with regard to meth cases. And because of the reductions, we've had to reduce down in terms of what cases we take. We basically take every murder case that is referred to us from rural Minnesota. We still take some meth cases. They're financed by a burn grant from the federal government. That burn grant may go away, and this was in anticipation of hopefully being able to keep some lawyers working on meth cases. Equity stripping has been a pain. Hopefully this one can go away. We entered into about a half dozen lawsuits in the last year on equity stripping. It's a very, very bad practice. Probably 500 to 800 homes affected, and they're extraordinarily difficult to handle. I mean, one attorney will be working trying to get people back in their homes for months. I mean, they'll be doing it with 75 files, but it's the damage to these people is horrendous, and if we can get them back in their home, that would be good. We hope that somewhere along the line, either the U.S. attorney or county attorney will prosecute one of these guys criminally. We've been very open in saying that. We think that people engaged in this activity would go away once a action would take place. Antitrust cases, we've been very, very limited in antitrust cases. We've been essentially gutted the department as a result of the division as a result of the cuts. We basically take some antitrust cases, but only if it's intrastate, basically in the state of Minnesota. Very narrow in terms of our ability to do anything. Tobacco-related matters, we're essentially out of the business. However, there are issues that come up. One, for instance, is a variety of states are taking action against these newer tobacco companies that did not participate in the settlement. They're collecting, well, if Minnesota were involved, we'd collect $4 million. And right now we're taking a pass on it because we don't have an expert involved in it, nor do we have the finances for an expert, nor do we have an attorney. We have been talking with finance about that. How do we get $75,000 to go get $4 million for the state? Seems like a no-brainer. Pharmaceutical litigation. The states, a variety of states, most states are involved in average wholesale price litigation, which is essentially recouping money as a result of overcharges for Medicaid to the state. And we're talking tens of millions of dollars. We're involved in it, but in a very, very limited fashion. And there's some big money there that ought to be had. That's essentially a brief overview of it.
Okay, do we have questions from members? One question I had, Mr. Attorney General, is when there's a murder case in a county like in my area where it's not very wealthy and so forth, do you just provide the service?
There was a time in the mid-90s or early 90s where it was billed. The problem is it puts a lot of pressure on the county attorney because they might be able to do it. They may only get one murder case every 5 years, and it's very hard for the county attorney to justify paying for a lawyer, an investigator, and everybody else coming out there. The way I look at it, and I subscribe to the idea that the rural county should not have to pay for this, a murderer might be in Marshall County, might be in Lyon County. That guy might be in Hennepin County next week. I mean, it's important we get these guys off the street. It is unfair to ask a rural county attorney has to do everything. I mean, it's a very difficult job. They're doing the civil work, they're doing construction litigation, they're advising the county board. They're doing misdemeanors in some cases, felonies in others. It's a lot to ask those people to have to go to a murder case. We have several lawyers in the office. That's all they do is murder cases. Bill Klump probably is the best. I believe he's the best prosecutor in the state. I just don't think it's fair to the county attorneys. Our object here for public safety is to get these guys off the street. And I don't want to put a county attorney in a position where they don't ask for the assistance and we end up with one of these guys getting out.
Very good. Representative DeLaForest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate your comments earlier about how we might need a little bit extra time for a new guy like myself, new to the committee and fairly new to the legislature. Good morning, Mr. Hatch. Thanks for appearing. I think I'm the only one on this committee trained in the law. So, well, I know that makes Cranky happy, but I had a couple questions just regarding, for my edification, your relationship with state agencies. I think people know generally and specifically under Chapter 8 that you are counsel for the state, essentially, for its officers and for boards and commissions and other things. And I was wondering, does that mean that you're always the attorney for them? Are there situations in which the Attorney General's office would not act as an attorney? Is there a process by which a state agency might say, for various reasons, we don't want the Attorney General's office? Because I know that can be, of course, added expense if we already have people on your staff.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the way the Constitution works and the way the law is in this country is the Attorney General's office sets the legal policy. So basically, the agency does not have a choice in that matter. We represent. Now, if we determine that there's a conflict, or if there's another process, and I can't remember what it says, if the Chief Justice, the Governor, and the Attorney General agree, then an outside counsel can be appointed. There's a matter by courtesy. There are examples, and it comes up every year, where we'll have a disagreement. We'll just say, hire your own. But more often than not, what we just simply do is say, no, we won't take the case. It's important. There are many, many cases. This is the difference between private practice and public practice. There are many cases where the courts hold that an agency can't go to court on their own. It's important, and believe me, there are some screwy cases where agencies would like to do that where you'd never want them to be going. And it's important for the office to act as that stopgap. And the courts have been very strong in saying that that's what the legal policy is. If there is a conflict, we work it out.
And Mr. Chairman and Mr. Hatch, then I would assume that even though there's a difference sometimes between public and private representation, all the rules of professional responsibility and attorney-client privilege attaches to your office and your attorneys and their relationship in representing the state agencies and everyone else?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, except that the rules on representation are different for public attorneys as opposed to private, much different.
Okay. And Mr. Chairman, if I had one more question, to turn to the funding. Mr. Hatch, help me understand here. It sounds like what you're telling me, you do get a direct appropriation from the general fund for your office, but yet you had, I think, what you called a partnership or some type of arrangements with state agencies. Is that a traditional billable hours type arrangement, or how are rates set? Is there a negotiation? Can you give me a flavor for how that works?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, there is a negotiated rate. We're supposed to charge back exactly what we generate in terms of cost. But then we still end up with this negotiation process, and I can't remember what it said. Is it about $100 or so?
It's $100 for attorneys and $55 for legal assistants.
Okay.
Currently.
Roughly $100 for attorneys and $55 for legal assistants. And the agency will estimate roughly how many hours they will need during the year. I mean, obviously, because we can't just lay off lawyers and hire them based upon a monthly basis. At the end of the year, we then do a catch-up, and if it's 10, I think most of them are, if there's a 10% leeway, if we're within a 10%, within 10% up or down of that target amount, we just eat it, we keep it. If it goes above 10 or below 10, then basically we pay them back. But it gives it, there's a little leeway at the year end.
And Mr. Chairman and Mr. Hatch, is that something that you do with every state agency and every board, or if it isn't, which ones do you negotiate with and which ones don't, and what happens to the people that don't negotiate with you?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it varies, and it's, there's a list of them. I don't know if you've got them there, but I'll read you the list of them that have, and some of them have both. Some of them have a partnership agreement, but we also use general funds. It's very, very odd. And believe me, I don't like it, but it's not worth it. If you get into this thing, you'll spend days. And I gave up. I just gave up on it. One is MnDOT Transportation has one, Teachers Retirement Association, Public Safety, the PCA, Petrol Tank Release Board, PIRA, Natural DNR, State Retirement System, MnSKU, Minnesota Racing Commission, which is tiny, the IRRRB, the DHS, MHFA, HESO, Health, Gambling Control Board, Corrections, Department of Education, the Agricultural Utilization Research Institute, and Administration Risk Management. And the fact that they, again, as I go through those, I can see even if they do have some provision, there's still general fund money that's utilized with some of those agencies.
Mr. Hatch, I guess I have a question on when I look at the budget booklet, and it states the activities provide expert legal advice and representation to the state agencies. And I'm on 15. It's toward the end. And it gives a list of, very similar to what you gave us, and corrections is one of the clients that you have in providing expert legal advice. If you go back to page 7, earlier, under civil commitment, there's some commentary on the budget booklet about corrections department failing to give notice to counties, ignoring statutory mandate to make determinations on civil commitments might be appropriate, and improperly releasing people. I mean, if you look at that, if you're providing the expert legal advice, is this? I mean, you're probably not advising them to do these things. But you know, how does that work? If you're saying these are my clients and I'm their attorney, and at the same time they're doing improper things, is there just a failure to communicate, or what's the issue there?
Well, Mr. Chairman, there's a lot of communication at a fairly high decibel level between the agency and our office. It's a, I mean, we've been very critical, but that's nonetheless, if they ask us for legal help, we provide it. But in terms of these items, we have repeatedly told them, they've got to, the problem is this, the way the statutes read is that a year before release, and I understand in some cases you can't do it, you know, just for whatever reason, something slips up in the system. But the statute says a year before release, these psychologists at the department are supposed to look at the file, make a determination as to whether this guy should be committed, contact the county attorney, refer the file to them. And the reason for that notice is so that the county attorney can get the file, retain his own psychologist, look at it, make a determination, and if he decides to go forward, go through the civil commitment process, which can take a half a year. What's going on is that, and I think what happened is after murder of Drew Shadeen, there was a lot of catch-up. I don't think people, there were no referrals going on. And so all of a sudden, with it, even on a month's notice, a county attorney would get notice of a guy getting out that they think, well, in fact, excuse me, they didn't even give any more opinions. Even though the statute says you got to give a recommendation, they're supposed to be making a recommendation to the county attorneys whether this guy should be committed. After the murder of Drew Shadeen, all files were referred and no recommendations were made. Now, if you're in Lyon County and you end up with getting 5 files, you've never had a file before. All you're getting before is you're getting a recommendation. You're told, this guy's got a problem here, big problem, have a psychologist look at it. Now we've changed the rules. Even though the statute says you got to make that recommendation, you're supposed to make it. All of a sudden, the county attorney is getting 5 files, 5 people. He doesn't know. He doesn't have a board, of, you know, he doesn't have a panel of psychologists out there. So what we did is, and it'll be a month to go. And in some cases, what happened is these people would be, a petition would be started, and then the county's got to pay for the keeping of this guy in a state hospital, which is very expensive. It's $100,000 a year. That's a big burden to a rural county. And we have had instances where we've had arguments between counties as to who's going to pay for a fellow and getting into kind of a negotiation because it's very expensive. If they're referred a year beforehand, we don't have to worry about that. It's the late referrals that cause the problem. So that was the reason for the beef. And that's the reason why this is listed. It just causes a lot more work trying to get these things, trying to get the commitments done as fast as possible. Now, as I indicated, however, as I've been meeting with these lawyers and going over the, you know, the pace, because my assumption is that 75 from last year is an aberration, it's catch-up, that it's going to drop. And they're telling me they're a little concerned here, it's not dropping. I mean, they're sending them to these psychology boards. We've established these psychology boards. They're not by statute. The statutes say corrections is supposed to be making these recommendations. They're not doing it. The county attorneys need some direction. So what we did is we put on, we reached an agreement with three panels of psychologists. We put together panels of two. It's got to be unanimous. Three panels of two. And if a county attorney chooses to utilize them, they pay them $2,500, and then we go get all the files. We do the legwork, get the files for the psychologists. They look at it, make the recommendation. And that's not in our budget. I mean, we're doing what you're already appropriating for corrections. This stuff should have been done a year before the release. That's the reason for the angst on my part. And I realize why it's going on. Nobody wants to take responsibility. Everybody's afraid there's going to be another Rodriguez getting out. But nonetheless, we got a job to do, and we all have to do it. I mean, this thing will work its way out through this session. I'm assuming whatever bills are going to happen, the right agencies will get authority. I'm not going to. If you want me to do that stuff, fine. You know, I don't care. I want to make sure we do our job as a state, though. I'll leave it at that. It's a touchy area, and I apologize for getting excited about it.
That's fine. Let me see. Does any members have questions on other items? I had Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Attorney General Hatch, when I meet with my county board and my law enforcement in the counties, they're extremely concerned about the huge increase in cost as it relates to meth and the meth use and the meth manufacturing, and particularly in rural Minnesota. That seems to be where the epidemic is, where we're making it. And county boards and others are just groping for help from the state to help deal with it. And I know the governor has had some recommendations as well to try to deal with it. But from a legal standpoint, from the county attorney standpoint, it's kind of a new thing for them as well, how to prosecute it. Can you tell me how your agency, your office, helps them, or what you're proposing to help, or what kind of relationship or bill back and so forth there might be with the counties on this issue? And then also, does the governor's proposal on that, it's in a different division than us, but does that have some of that money flowing to those counties and others?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, I think the governor's proposal is good, and I think we're all in agreement pretty much on what to do. With regard to the prosecution, we do have two attorneys that are on what are called burn grants from the federal government, and that's all they do is meth cases. In 1999, just to show you the explosion, we had two cases. I think that last year we had over 100. And these meth cases, I went to a conference in North Dakota. Over 10% of the kids in high school have tried meth. Statistics indicate that if you have tried meth more than once, you got a 70% likelihood of becoming addicted. There is a lot of controversy over whether there's an appropriate treatment plan out there. Some people say you can never get treated, it causes permanent damage. Others say it takes 8 to 9 months to detoxify. I think Hazleton says that a 28-day program can work, but I run into cops who tell me, and other people familiar with this field who don't believe that. I got in a big dispute with some health professionals. I've gone out to college campuses and I've asked them, what about this? What do we do about it? And they believe that you got to do something in high school, not in college, in high school. And you got to notify these kids that meth is different than other drugs. Now that drives these health professionals crazy. They don't want, that was the proposal I made at this one conference. And they believe that all addiction's the same, tobacco, alcohol, marijuana, heroin, and meth. My point is, maybe that's fine for the health people, And I don't want to send the wrong signal here to a class in high school, but somebody has got to start talking about what the devastation that meth causes. Because it's too easy, especially these young girls. And you're right, the drug started differently. Most drugs start in the metropolitan area and work out. Meth has started in the rural area and it's worked in. The other, so if there's anything that I'd like to see happen, and I'm not the expert, but I would hope smarter people than I here can propose it. Develop some program where we can go out to these high schools, because it is so expensive, where we can tell these kids up front, take a meth addict, maybe take a woman who's in prison. You know, if you see the before and after pictures, they're horrible. And get them out there and say, this is thin. This is what you mean by getting thin. But do something to let these kids know that what they're dealing with here is an absolute utter poison. Because once they're addicted, it doesn't matter. You can put on 20-year life imprisonment. It doesn't matter. Pregnant women will take meth, knowing it will kill or ruin their baby. There's no deterrence with the jail terms on meth. We've got to do, and the health cost is so expensive. I really believe we've got to warn these kids up front. I don't know how, but I think we've got to do something on it. Number two, very bothersome to me, is that 80% of meth is distributed out of super labs in California. You know, we go off and we're going to go fix Sudafed and the no-dose at the truck stops and if they go to Fleet Farm and get veterinary supplies, and horses use pseudoephedrine. But that's only 20% of the problem. What's being cooked, most of the laws we're referring to and most of the focus in this country is only with the 20% that's being cooked. Now, that's a stronger type of drug, and that's where it started. But now we got 80% of them that run out of super labs in California run by the Mexican cartels. My beef is this, and this is a federal issue. But I mean, if you guys, somebody be interested, I'd draft a resolution, because I've talked to our congressional delegation and nobody, I mean, we're all after Sudafed, which is good. I mean, we ought to do something on that. But 80%, if you look at pseudoephedrine, comes from 9 labs in the world. They're in India, China, and Germany. Ephedrine was started by the Nazis, kept their planes up longer, kept their pilots awake, if you can imagine. 9 plants. There are 3,000 suppliers in the U.S. 3,000 suppliers, they order it in barrels. You know, so we look and we say, what are we doing in terms of safeguarding the shipment of this? We're worried about Sudafed. What about the pseudoephedrine in these cans? And then we go to the DEA and we find out this is not regulated as a controlled substance. They've got, they're licensed, all 3,000 of them. And we start looking at the lists and they're stored in people's garages, in foot lockers. It's crazy. You know, in this state, we got 30 of them. We just sent out subpoenas to all 30. And, you know, some of them I sure are good. You know, there's Target and Kmart and people like that. But, you know, one guy on university sells pseudoephedrine, eyeglasses, and cigarette lighters. I don't know. We'll see what he responds. But my beef is that the DEA ought to be regulating pseudoephedrine as a controlled substance, as just like heroin. We know, you know, other than Sudafed, and frankly, at the truck stops, how many truckers do you want hopped up anyway? And I know horses need it, you know, to clear out their congestion and all that. But maybe we ought to be regulating this drug one step down. The base drug, the pseudoephedrine. And that takes a federal law. We don't, there should not be 3,000 distributors of pseudoephedrine in this country. Not when 1/6 of the drug is ending up in illegal cookers. That's crazy.
I don't think you answered my question. No.
Well,
we were out of the committee, sorry.
All right.
Go ahead.
But I really want to know what my county attorney wants to know is,
okay,
how is your office, you know, proposing to help them on that, if at all? What does it take for us to get some money in there to help them?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holbert, we're not. I mean, we've got 2 attorneys on burn grants. Those are the 2 doing it, but it's a big state. We serve basically 80 counties. So we can't do any more unless we have when we can retain lawyers. We did put in a budget here for one lawyer, I believe. And I'm not even going to pretend that's going to address the issue, but the...
Okay. Mr. Hatch, I just had a question on... I had a booklet on health care that your office put together, and
yep.
I thought it was pretty interesting, actually, and some of the things. I actually have a nonprofit bill that our committee gets to listen to later next week that reflects some of the things that you have in here. I'm just wondering who all got one of these. I ended up getting mine from the legislative library, but was there a...
What it's designed for, I drafted that, designed for basically like rotaries, chambers, commercial clubs, things like this. When I get to about basically with the employer population, this is the biggest business tax paid in America right now. And you'll note it's not written in, I drafted it myself. There, I bet you'll see a number of errors in there, but it's so I called it working draft.
Well, I didn't see any, but...
But the idea is to try to get to the guy who pays the premium, to go to those businesses. I put in those editorial cartoons, the idea being, because healthcare, you can die of boredom real quick. You get so many statistics. So the idea is to put it together, get out to these groups, kind of get into the issue of healthcare. It's in a very complicated area. It has some proposals that are, you know, at the outer edge. But the idea is to get people to think about it. Although the one, in terms of allowing employers to carve out to buy coverage from the state for the sick employees, I think is a good idea. That's the erosion is occurring with small employers. And people write in. I mean, it's the biggest issue we've got in healthcare. I mean, people are constantly. I mean, healthcare is the biggest issue we've got in the state right now. More complaints. We probably get about 500 complaints a day. Calls, complaints, letters. I'll estimate that 20% of those, at least, 20% relate to health care directly, and probably another 20% relate to health care indirectly. It'll be a complaint regarding underwriting. It could be collections. Some of our lawsuits on collections, really, if you look back to it, relate to health care. And so we send that out. We send that out to those people as well. So people will call up the Nurses Association. Can you distribute it to our people? Bring it out, and we will.
Okay. Can we get a list of who's all getting one? The health committee said that only the chair got one, and the rest of the health committee looked at each other and said never got one. But could you give us a list in writing at some point of who all got one of these things and so forth? I found it more interesting than the health care bills I read. Mm-hmm. Maybe the cartoons souped it up a little for me, but I'm not on the health committee, but I think the health committee would find it interesting, but I just kind of like to know who ended up all getting one of these. And
I will send one to each of the representatives. I thought we'll do that.
Okay. And maybe how many copies have been printed or something would be a good idea. Do we have any more? I know we're going to try to get Auditor Anderson in here. We've got plenty of time. If Representative Pepin, I have you down on the list.
Mr. Hatch, you talked a little bit about your staff size, your attorneys going, I think you said 520 to 350 at the beginning of your presentation. I think that was from 1999. And I was looking on page 7, and you were requesting $810,000 for eight additional attorney positions and one investigator position. And I'm wondering just a little bit about what happened to some of those folks. Did they go to attrition, or were they let go, or did they retire? And then wondering if the eight people you were looking to hire will be people that had left that will be rehired. Just kind of wondering what had happened with some of those folks.
Well, a lot were laid off.
Mr. Hatch.
Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. Representative, a number of them were laid off. 1999, we probably laid off 50, at least 50. And I think we've had a series of rounds of layoffs. And they're very difficult. There's no doubt about it. But it was a necessary part of the budget process, and it's not fun. But we would not, whatever we hired would be, you know, it might be somebody from the past, but not likely. I mean, it could be, but there's no rehire policy in the office. If we find, for instance, if you authorized another meth lawyer, we would look specifically for a criminal lawyer with experience in drugs. It would not be a lawyer who is in the environmental area who we would retrain. We're real big on getting experience in it. We're too small now. We don't hire new lawyers. We haven't hired a new, I don't know if we've hired, I think we've hired about two new lawyers in 6 years. We try to get lawyers with experience. We hire out of the county attorney's offices at times. You can find people there who have about 3, 4, 5 years of experience. They've been in court. But it's hiring is the most difficult part of the job.
Mr. Hitch, does that follow like a seniority system in your, you know, like unionized and so forth?
No.
Because our committee deals with that all the time, or you have kind of at-will employment?
Mr. Chairman, we're all of our employees, other than secretaries, are at-will. Secretaries, I think, are a member of the union.
Okay. Representative Pepin.
So the people that have been let go, is it because of poor functioning on their job, or just because of needed budget cuts, or what were the circumstances? Also wondering if they are they given severance packages, or what happens with
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pepin, there it could be a variety. I mean, I don't know what the division is, probably 150 to 200 lawyers that have and investigators that have been let go for a variety of reasons. Clearly budget stems from a lot of them, but also frankly there were policy differences going in 1999, and they were reflected. They were about we used to have what are called policy directors, and we do not have those. They all were eliminated in the first week. We used to have, I think, 6 deputies and 1 chief. We now have, what, 4? 3 deputies? 4 deputies. Three deputies and a chief. We've reduced the managers, so it's a much more vertical type arrangement. We're very big on, in fact, with the agencies, this is a big issue on the agencies, is we don't take, we will tell them what cases, we just can't take certain cases. And that's one way, that's budgetary in nature, but you have to be a pretty decent lawyer to be able to look at a case and say, wait, is this really what you want to be tying up the courts with? Is this really the right thing to be doing with the citizen? Is this really furthering the policy? It's just you're kind of a checkpoint, and you need to have the lawyers involved in that have to have some experience. You can't take a young lawyer, they'll sue everything.
Can I just ask one more follow-up?
Sure.
Just wondering, I asked you about severance. Do they get, did the people that get let go, do they get a severance package? If you could just talk a little bit about what
well, they get,
sort of they get.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, there is a, in some cases, I know we've resolved cases where they'll be like, they get, what is it, 2 months of, yeah, 2 months. 2 months of pay.
Mr.
Okay.
Chair? Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chair,
But Mr. Chairman, Representative Pepin, I should mention, it's not really a severance. I mean, we require a settlement of all claims, so there's no, you know, we're dealing with lawyers who can easily sue, so we say, we've never had a suit. I've laid off 175 people who've never been sued. No claims filed. But one of the reasons is we sit down with them right off the bat. It's not fun. We try to be upfront. And I think we're about the only state agency that's not been sued. And we probably laid off more than any agency. And I think the use of that agreement is probably a key to it.
Representative Solder.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hatch, you mentioned that you have not and don't expect to hire people fresh out of college, out of law school. One of the issues that in my previous sitting on this committee was always the pay that Attorney General's office paid lawyers as compared to a lawyer coming into the private practice. And it was always that, you know, we're not competitive.
Right.
Lawyers can make a lot more money in private practice than they can in state government. And that was one of the reasons I think why people were their first job out of law school was Attorney General's office for a couple of years to get some experience at a lower pay. Talk to me a little bit about your ability that you view as your ability to recruit experienced and good attorneys in these areas, pay-wise.
And we're going to try to wrap up by 9:30, so we've got another 10 minutes if there's any other questions.
Okay.
Doing a great job and following up and everything, so go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, that is the most difficult part of the office. One of the issues, part of these layoffs, be very candid, part of the layoffs were it was to raise the attorneys' salaries. At one point, 1999, the pay of a member of the Attorney General's office was a third less than the pay at a metropolitan area city attorney or county attorney's office. It was awful. And so you had this, you know, people who are working there for 5-10 years, they're looking at a family and kids, and they say, why am I doing this when I could be doing traffic tickets and making a third more? And they left. And we needed to stop that hemorrhage. They could go to a state agency and get paid a third more. It was a ridiculous pay schedule. We did do layoffs to raise salaries. I mean, I'd be very blunt on it. It was very important that we stop that type of attrition. We're still behind. The average attorney general makes less than, for instance, the equivalent at the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, Ramsey, Dakota, Anoka, Washington, Carver. But we've narrowed the gap appreciably. I think maybe 10%, I'm hoping. And I hope that that's sufficiently narrow that we don't lose them. We have much less attrition now on the good ones. In fact, I think we've stopped it. And they got a great pride. It's a great office for lawyers. There's a great deal of pride historically in that office by the people who work there, and I think they are well respected in their field. In terms of recruitment, it is very difficult from private practice. You do try to find, there's a certain, if you look for academic excellence, but you want to get some experience of people actually going into court. They need to have taken depositions and done those type of things. So 3 to 5 years is about optimum. And it's amazing where you pick them. It's not, you want them to work. One of our problems in this office, and actually this goes on in many other areas, these kids come out of school, they're heavily in debt, and they've got to work. They got to pay those bills. When I graduated from law school, it was fairly common for you could get out of there with very little debt, and you could go into a public agency. You could do that commitment to serve your state and get involved in the community, do good things and all of that. Public service, that's why you're all here. Today, a kid coming out of law school is probably $75,000 in debt. It's huge, huge debt. They don't have that luxury anymore. So it's hard to find that type of, even 3 years out. We can't hire them out of there anyway because of our own budget, but even 3 to 5 years out, they're still paying their bills. It's very hard to get that public commitment going. So we look for it. We look for the expertise. But I'm telling you, that's the art of it. The chief deputy does all. Chief deputy and the solicitor general do all of the screening, and they. It's the most difficult part of the job.
Hey, Representative De La Forest, and we'll see if there's any other questions, and we'll wrap up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hatch, you mentioned in your testimony a few minutes ago about the high decibel dialogue you've been having with the Department of Corrections, and so think about this as another area in which your relationship with the state agencies isn't like the private sector. There's sort of this shotgun wedding where you have to get along with each other, and I think it's of concern to any member of the legislature and the citizens when state agencies and their attorney are not getting along. And I had basically three related questions with respect to that issue. First of all, what is sort of your assessment of your office's relationship with the state agencies in general? I'm sure there is a range of them, but are things going in the right direction, the wrong direction? Second, how do you measure your client's satisfaction? After all, your office is there to serve clients. Do you have empirical methods, or do you go out to lunch with folks? And third, You know, what do you do if there is a conflict between your office and one of the state agencies? How do you attempt to resolve that to work together?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, our clients are not, that our object is not just simply to satisfy the clients. That's the difference. We represent the state. We represent the people of the state. If an agency is wrong, we tell them they're wrong. That doesn't mean it's bad. That's good. That's very good because we represent the people. We don't cave in because if an agency is wrong, we tell them. In this case, go ask a county attorney. I don't know where you're from. I apologize. But if you go ask a rural county attorney about what's going on in sex offenders, they'll tell you up front that they got dumped and it created a lot of problems. And I was vocal on it. And it's important to be vocal on it. We don't want to cover it up. You don't want to cover it up. The people in the state are better served. If you have in every state, the Attorney General, and by the way, we just had a big deal. It was the state of Utah. Ironically, and you might think this is a partisan thing, the most friction occurs is when the Attorney General and the Governor are in the same party. Because what happens is the Governor will use, that's odd, but it is, because the Governor will then use the political party to put pressure on the Attorney General to get in line and, you know, take care of them. And the Attorney General bucks back because he's representing the people. In Utah, we had this long, long ethics presentation on where they had these juvenile boot camps, and they were contracted out, and all these kids were sexually abused. And the Attorney General's office was investigating it. The Governor's office was saying, well, the Attorney General can't be doing that. You've got to take a hit for us. And they're saying we're enforcing the law. Now, whose client, and that always is the question you ask, is an attorney general or a county attorney, but particularly as an attorney general. And this issue that I just bring up in Utah happens in every state every year. In Utah, it's two people out of the same party. The Utah attorney general said, no, we investigate this. These boot camps are out of control. The Department of Corrections was not looking at them. These kids were harmed. They sued. Now, that doesn't, the governor was absolutely upset. Corrections was absolutely upset in Utah. But the Attorney General did what he had to do. That's ethical and it's appropriate. You don't want an Attorney General coddling to an agency ever. If you do that, corruption occurs. It's good to have that tension. Just like you have tension between the executive and the legislative branch. That's okay. Part of the process by way of democracy.
Hey, do we have Representative Pepin? You got 5 more minutes.
Mr. Hatch, I just have a follow-up question to that. I was looking at page 15, and you listed the population served in that little box called Activity at a Glance. It says you provide expert legal advice and representation to state agencies. So I guess it's kind of a follow-up to Representative De La Forest. And you said you felt that it was important to not necessarily agree with the agencies. I'm wondering, in these instances, I remember the State Farm case last year, and it appeared to me that you essentially worked against one of the State Departments. So I'm wondering, in these instances, do the agencies get billed even though you're working against them, or how exactly does that work from a legal perspective? Because I'm not an attorney, so it's a little confusing to me.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pepin, I don't think we were working against the interests of Department of Commerce. We were representing the people of this state. The issue in that case, if I recall, I'm trying to think what was the issue in that case. It was redlining. It was redlining, changing the rates based upon the age of the home, even though the home had been updated with regard to wiring. So that was the key issue. The only actuarial issue in terms of the having an effect was wiring. And what State Farm was doing is saying, we don't care if you've rewired it or not, we're still going to have a surcharge. And the Commerce Department in 1999 took an action against State Farm saying, what you're doing is redlining. In the year 2002, the Commerce Department settled the case with State Farm. State Farm agreed, we won't do this again. And in 2003, State Farm then filed another policy saying we're going to go ahead and do it. So you had a Commerce Department, two Commerce Commissioners coming up with exact opposite opinions. Now the case was in court with a private citizen, and they were asked about our opinion in that case, about filing an amicus. We filed an amicus opinion, which represented the opinion of the Department of Commerce as it related to the order that was signed in 2002, which we do believe is appropriate. But that is the that was redlining. In fact, and I don't know all the facts. I could be wrong in terms of what I'm saying, but I believe that was the issue. And the Commerce Department obviously changed its mind on that issue. But that doesn't mean that we're supposed to be changing our mind. We enforce law. This is a classic case where you don't want an attorney general just doing exactly what an agency does. You're going to have which Commerce Department are we going to represent there? And now, in the end, in fact, in that case, the governor intervened and actually reversed the Commerce Department. So who would we represent then? The governor will reverse the Commerce Department, or the Commerce Department which reversed itself?
Okay, do we have Representative Pepin?
Still, just a follow-up to that, I did ask about, do the different agencies get billed? Because it has seemed to me, and I don't have examples in front of me, but it has seemed to me that, like, that wasn't the only example of, you know, instances where you've not necessarily sided with the agencies. I'm wondering, in that type of instance, do you still bill the state agency for service, or how does that work?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pepin, no, in that case, we did not. Actually, in Commerce's case, we don't bill anything.
Okay. That's
a general appropriation.
Okay.
And when we represent, when we filed the brief, we're not filing it on behalf of the Department of Commerce. It was on behalf of the Consumer Division of our office. It's a entirely different division.
Do you have any more questions on this? Mr. Hatch, thank you. There's been some talk at the agencies that maybe there's a lot of settlement where the agencies get pinned down for big settlements versus litigating things. Any thoughts on that as they've kind of come around and so forth?
Well, Mr. Chairman, that will happen. I mean, that is always that's always historically always been an issue where the lawyer says, you know, we do think you got a bad case here. Oddly enough, in private practice, this is where private practice is much easier in a lot of respects. But generally speaking, if it's coming out of the client's own pocket, they understand the value of settlements. The problem is sometimes when you're dealing with a public agency, you're dealing with somebody, they don't care, it's not their money. And so we're dragging through court and we're saying, listen, this is not a smart thing for the state's interest. Now, then in the end, they'll call the shot. The courts have said the Attorney General can settle cases without the consent of the agency. I don't think we've ever done it. I mean, we want the agency on board. We're not going to get into that type of deal. But we will talk to them about it. But if an agency insists, I mean, generally it works it out. It's, you know, MnDOT, for instance. MnDOT and the lawyers, I don't think we've ever had a beef. I mean, they communicate very well. They're always settling cases. We had beefs from the other side. You know, they don't think they're ever getting enough money. Where you get into the touchy ones are an employee lawsuit. Somebody gets terminated, and so they sue the state, they sue the agency, and so you're dealing with the superiors in that agency. In many cases, they feel outraged that their integrity was questioned, and they don't see the value of settling the case. And those are the hardest ones.
Okay, any last questions? All right, if we could get that information on how many booklets went out and to
yep.
who, that would be great. Maybe by Monday or sometime next week is fine for me. Thank you so much. Appreciate you personally coming over and giving us your budget. Very good answers to the questions. And we're right at 9:30. We're right on time. And we have the state auditor here. Good morning.
Great.
And you could introduce yourself and... Members, I think this is on in the budget booklet. This is after the Secretary of State, but before the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
And this is once again a difference. The governor offers one thing, and the auditor offers one thing. And introduce yourself and give us a little overview of your functions and so forth, and proceed.
Thank you, Representative Seifert. I'm Pat Anderson. I'm the state auditor. I think that what we did is provided a second handout. I don't want you to quite go to that yet, but this is, I think, a better document to work off to talk about what we do, and it's sort of a consolidated budget of the governor's various recommendations. But maybe I could start with what's in your packet. If you look at the governor's budget on page 2, in your packet. There are four or five different either items or change items, and I guess what I'd like to do, if it's all right with the committee, is tell you how we feel about them and whether they're added. And essentially, we are accepting the governor's recommendations for his budget. So our final budget includes those things that the governor has recommended. I'll go through them one by one to give you an idea. The first page two of the governor's recommendation is the overall just agency overview, and I believe it's there's a variety of appropriations, but it's sort of the base budget. If you look at page three, this is the 2.5% reduction he's done for all state agencies, and it's on the non-revenue producing areas, and it's actually only $50,000 a year for us, and we accept that, and we have put that into our final budget document. Page four is it's essentially the same thing. It's a 2.5% base reduction. Again, we accept that. If you move on into the initiative section on page seven of the governor's recommendation, this is change item that I'll talk about more in depth, but it's essentially a restoration of out-of-practice staffing. If you look under the recommendation in the last sentence, it does say the governor supports this change item. There's essentially a zero figure. Because we recoup all of our costs, there's no net change to the general fund. So there is no extra cost to the general fund on this item. Again, I'll go into that in detail.
Okay, excuse me, Representative.
He's going to go into that in detail.
Okay.
Yeah, I will.
I think Representative Solberg wanted a little more information on that one.
Yep. And then page eight is a change item we requested, which is essentially inflation, and we will no longer be requesting that since we're not going to get it anyway. So we have then put it all together. So essentially we're in agreement with the governor's recommendation. And what we've done is, if you look at the packet that we handed out to you, this puts it all together and it breaks it down by division. And so if it's all right with the committee, I'll work off of this document.
Okay.
Essentially, the overall budget includes not only general fund operating expenses, but or appropriations, but we get a variety of funding from other sources. Our TIF division is funded directly by a fee off tax increments. Our pension division is funded separately. Our government information gets a little bit of LGA. And our out-of-practice division recoups its costs by state statute. So in other words, when we go out and audit our local governments, audit our clients, we're essentially charging them back, and they are paying back the general fund. And so if you look at the bottom line, the proposed budget, the estimated recovery, and then the estimated net general fund expenditures, there's only about a $2.7 or $2.8 million net to the general fund for my office. That is about $500,000 less than the previous biennium. Change item, I guess, is in the audit practice division. And if you look at page two, this gives you a little bit of information about that. Our audit practice division, again, we audit several hundred local units of government. We have authority to audit all 3,000. We'll look at page two. This gives you a little bit of information about that. Our audit practice division, again, we audit several hundred local units of government. We have authority to audit all 3,000 local units of government. And so we go out and do, and by the way, if we don't do it, they have to have a private CPA do it. So it isn't like we're auditing over and above what's going on. And we have regular clients who regularly audit all the counties, cities of first class. A lot of this is in statute already. We have asked that we restore our staffing level to previous level of a few years ago so that we're able to do audits. We found ourselves in the position where we are turning down audits that perhaps aren't people's charters. We had one last week. The city of Minneapolis asked us to do a special audit, and we don't have the staff to do it. It's going to cost them $90,000 to go out and have it done privately, which is significantly more than we would charge them. And so we're in this position where we just can't do the work, even though in the vast majority of cases we are cheaper, and we're being asked to do this by the local governments. And so the historically, and I've talked to some of you about this, back under Auditor Carlson and previous to that, we actually had a revolving fund. So this was completely off budget with the legislature. In other words, we just did out the work and we had our little account and the money went back into this account. Well, what happened is there was some abuses to that supposedly under an auditor, and I think they were buying furniture or something that the legislature didn't want you, had turned down in a previous budget request. And so it was brought under the legislature. So you were heavily involved in that at the time. But the ceiling is set, and I'm simply asking for the ceiling to be raised so that we can do the work that needs to get done on this. And maybe I'll take some specific questions on this.
Yeah, Representative DeLaForest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Madam Auditor. The question I have is that recently or in the past few years, there's been a proliferation of different types of governmental units, port authorities or development authorities, joint powers, boards, and other things. And sometimes they all spend money. Some of them have the ability to raise money on their own. Does your office also exercise oversight over these this jumble of sort of extra governmental bodies in addition to your other responsibilities for oversight?
Madam Auditor.
Mr. Chair, Mr. DeLaForest, we have oversight. We have not exercised a lot because we don't have the staff, frankly. We do have oversight overall. We are trying to do more in the area of we're reviewing city audits. We're trying to at least do a special district study, which we're supposed to, we're mandated by law to do, and hasn't been done in 20 years. And so there's a variety of things that just simply haven't gotten done because of staffing.
Representative Todd?
Well, Mr. Chairman and members,
I
strongly support this request. And I think one of the problems that we've gotten into in between the time when we established the when we stopped the revolving fund, which meant there was literally no legislative oversight over the activities, and when we set up this appropriation in return, is that we started getting into these things of general fund budget resolution, which only look at spending. And I think then that's then a serious problem with this. We need to have, and whether, however you guys are going to set your budget resolution, you really need to look at the kind of appropriations that are distinctly beneficial to the state. I mean, the local units of government wouldn't ask them to do it if they didn't think they were getting good service for their self, plus that it's more effective because they have the kind of knowledge of public spending which private firms don't quite have much. So this is something where we need to, if we're going to try and keep legislative oversight on it, we also need to do it in a way that's prepared to do a deficiency, prepared to do an extra, either prepared to over-appropriate from what their estimates are, that their estimates will never be perfect, knowing that that will be canceled at the end if it doesn't come back in, or be prepared to, you know, possibly when we did our deficiency bill, we should have had this item in the deficiency bill as a neutral item. I like the idea of legislative oversight, but I really don't like it when it ends up hampering the proper function of an office. And I don't think it's difficult to do it if we get out of the mindset that a budget resolution is only about spending and that some spending makes an enormous, like this one, you don't even have to look down long term to show the effectiveness of it. It just comes right back in. And we do have good enough budgeting and computer systems to take care of that. So, you know, if the auditor would even like thinks that they could even use more, I would be happy to put that in as long as you can figure out how to do it in the budget resolution. And the other thing is I would also be happy to say that we're going to look at it, you know, we're going to look at it halfway through the biennium and see what seems to be coming up and see if we need to do an extra appropriation next year. And just understand that even if it's not off budget in the way we do our accounting, it ought to be off budget in the way we think about it. Just ought to be, look at the job that they're doing. If we're happy with it, make sure that they continue doing it to what everyone else, what the local units of government or these other entities in the state want.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Khan. We had thought about requesting a revolving fund again like it was historically, and we just sort of, after talking to several people who were around at the time, we thought that probably wasn't a good request for, because I think it's important that there's still legislative oversight in what we're doing and how we're spending the money, ultimately, even though it comes back equally in fees. And so this is our way of dealing with it without going back to what we had historically.
Sure, I want to spend a little bit of time on government information.
Mm-hmm.
And it's offset to local government aid, general fund payments, and miscellaneous receipts. I'd like to have a little bit more information on that and what the function of that is. When you say government information, is that the local government aids, the type of cities that when you deduct their local government aid, then you give them a report saying they're getting too much local government aid, or what's involved in that line item?
This is page 5 of our handout, I guess.
I guess it is, yeah.
It's the best one. If you look under budget activity, government information is one of our divisions, and we do receive a percentage of essentially LGA, local government aid, comes to fund this division. The purpose of government information division is to do a variety of things. We collect data from all local units of government, and we're, again, trying to get all the special district information, but there are about 1,000 of them. We collect from cities, counties. We do all the statutory reports that you require us to do, including everything from the liquor store report to city spending reports, county spending, school district report, the special study. So all of the reports that we do, which you we traditionally send a copy over to you as legislators, comes out of that division. And everything that we do, or most of what we do, is required by statute to do all these certain reports.
Mr. Chairman, I'm on page 11 of this big book.
Mm-hmm.
It says this division also manages the information technology and network administration of the office.
Mm-hmm.
So am I to assume that all the technology, that requirements in your office, or the management of that technology, is being paid for by local units of government?
Madam Auditor?
Representative Silver, the head of this division oversees that area, but the technology part of our office, we have several IT people. We have a division that we call operations management, and it consists of our billing clerks, our IT staff. Who am I missing? That's about it, I guess. And they're called operations management. They do the payroll and so on. And their costs are actually divided amongst all the other departments across our office. So government information department would only pay a very small percentage of that. If you look at the original chart in the front, you can see that, let's see the first chart, that audit practice is the vast majority of our operation. It's about 80% of our operation is the actual audit practice. So government information is about 7% of our overall operation.
Mr. Chairman, that's not quite the question I answered. Let me try to rephrase it. Am I assuming then that the head of this particular department is paid entirely from the funds that are collected from that source, the government aid? General fund or local government aid?
The head of this division is a deputy. When I came into office, I also flattened the organization dramatically. We had to, because of costs and so on. The head of government information is a deputy who also does oversee the operations management division. His salary is paid for by several different divisions and funds. He's actually a deputy.
Page 20.
Mm-hmm.
Are you in the budget booklet or on the auditor's handout?
The budget booklet from the governor?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You may not have that. I'm not sure. The members will, but I'm not sure.
Well, it says $217,000 each year from local government aid to costs related to government information. Am I then to say that the rest of that comes from other areas of the 1.349?
Ma'am Auditor, or Representative Kahn, do you have an answer to this?
Let me say something about how this was done. This was figured out when we were sort of brought before us the idea that the auditor does a lot of stuff that doesn't benefit any specific local unit of government. So it doesn't fit the bill back model. But the question is, how are we going to kind of fund this? You know, it's almost like the story that we had before from the Attorney General about the just turning money back to the general fund when the amount per, or to the people when the amount per person is so little. So, well, these things kind of benefit the conduct of local government as a whole. Even if it's a report that a locality doesn't want, it supposedly is beneficial to the other localities who see this activity and say, well, we probably shouldn't be doing this. So this was just an easy way of taking this amount off the top from the local government aids instead of trying to bill back to every single local unit of government for this kind of activity. Again, one could argue that you should just do it from the general fund and that would work just as well.
I was
now,
wondering that because, you know, communities don't get local government aid, so you're kind of making certain communities pay, pull the wagon, if you will.
Well, you know, anytime you want to, it could be taken from the general fund. It was a way to tap a source of money for an activity that we seemed to need that wasn't from the general fund, and that was in there wasn't any way we could figure out how you could bill it back. Now, I guess the general department, when you see the auditor, when you go back to some of those graphs, when you tell it, the information systems person, I guess, should have 70% of their salary kind of paid. I mean, some of it gets paid from that audit practices fund,
right.
But then some of it also comes from this.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's the heart of my question, I think, is I'd like to, if you can give us
some
a breakdown.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm not complaining about that. I'd like to see, you know, if within that information technology or the other things, you know, what is the percentage of payments, and if you could provide that for us, I'd appreciate that.
Sure.
Representative Silver, Mr. Chair, if you look at, again, in my packet, the on page 3, the graph that has the breakdown, that's the breakdown of our divisions. The breakdown of that budget, the information system, or specifically if you're talking about the IT staff, would be identical to this budget.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if you can get those numbers to us, I'd appreciate that. And your deputies and so forth.
Absolutely. Matt Lindemann, who's next to me, is actually the head of the IT division. And he's been with the auditor's office for about 19 years.
Wow.
So.
Survived a lot of different characters.
A lot of different auditors over there.
That's always okay, do we have other questions from members?
You want to take that back, characters?
Well, not really. Yeah. What other questions do we have on Representative Kahn?
This is on page 11 of the
budget book?
Of the budget book.
Okay.
And it's the, one of the things I'm interested in is the auditor's activity in monitoring investment financial and actuarial reporting for the 730 public pension funds in Minnesota. And I'm specifically interested in the second sentence, which says that it tracks local tax dollars that are contributed to these funds and promotes fiscally sound management and compliance with state law. One of the state laws that I've seen kind of not perfect compliance with, and I think I'm interested in getting your office interested in doing that, is we require, the pension funds are required to submit economic interest. The offices of the pension funds are required to do this. At one point, they just were required to fill them out and keep them in their office, which is an interesting experience in trying to ever get to see them. I mean, I would ask you to ask any of your volunteer fire, find out where the office of your volunteer fire department is and find out how you could ever see these. So we changed the law to require them to be filed the same place we file them. And the last time I looked, so I don't want to pretend this is information that's less than a year old, there was very, very poor compliance with that law. You go to the campaign finance board and you just get a list, you know, it's a big list, 730. The big funds, I think, are really pretty good about doing that. But you get a list, you find a lot of ones that haven't done it. Besides that, worse than that, is that the campaign finance board doesn't have the staff to do anything more than just check. So if you have five board members and one person has sent it in, and they all send it in individually, if you have five board members and one person has sent it in, that's checked in as having reported, because they at least have something in a slot. And that's something that I think would be advantageous for us to look at. There's been, and we've had different discussion about this with different auditors, a lot of, I don't know if you want to say mismanagement of this, of these funds, but a lot of money left on the table, which sometimes really affects the individual volunteer firefighters in your area. And I think one of the first things to look at is to look, and they do have the option of investing their, of having the state board of investment take care of all their investment. Mm-hmm. And there's some people, and then I think that then frees them up from a lot of reporting requirements, which they thought was too onerous. But this is something which I think people ought to be interested in. You really ought to be interested in if you have what's, if your volunteer firefighter fund has what new legislators all have, which is a defined contribution instead of defined benefit form, set of funding the pensions, because that's something that the state takes no interest in, because it's defined contribution, then there's no deficit, and there's no deficit in the fund. But those are the places where your members, if the fund is not performing adequately or performing as well as it could, that's the place where your members are really getting it in the net. So, you know, it's something that I'd like to get some people in the legislature more interested in. But in fact, it's never, when you look at the problems of pension funds, unfortunately, this is like only, as opposed to $60 billion or something, this is only like $60 million, so it's not real big money compared to the problems of the bigger funds. But, you know, $60 million is the amount of money left on the table that we could be picking up, and I wish we'd be interested in. So,
good point.
Anyway, I guess the question to the auditor after that long diatribe was, what are you doing about to deal with that phrase and compliance with state law?
Ma'am,
thank you.
We're going to wrap up by 10. I apologize for cutting you short.
Maybe I'll, I did look into this particular issue, and campaign finances, they essentially put them in a box. They don't do anything with them. We have not ever looked to see if they filed the forms. That could be something that if the legislature, it isn't legally linked for us to approve their aid. Maybe for the rest of the committee's information, we oversee all of the Volunteer Fire Relief Association funds, and there are 700 and some odd funds across the state. And we certify them, their benefit levels, we certify them for compliance with state law so that they get their fire aid from you, the legislature. And we do that every year through this division. And there's a variety of things that we check off on, and most of it is related to benefit levels and so on. But we have never looked at the issue that Representative Kahn is discussing, whether they actually filed their proper forms, and then what do those forms say? Because they're allowed to invest in things that traditional pension plans maybe want, and a lot of times it does create issues. So.
Well, I'm just saying, and I don't know about the control of the investments is obviously a different issue that deals with judgment and that kind of thing, but the filing of the forms is state law, and it seems to me that if they don't file their forms, you could hold up their payment. They have to fill them out. They're required to file, you know, even though we don't, it's not specifically listed, just the phrase compliance with state law, which you sign off on before you do it, ought to be enough to make give you the power to look at it. And somehow, I think that if you said if you don't file these forms, you're not going to get your payments, it would kind of catch their attention.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think you need any new law to specifically link it to it. But I think the existing law, you know, it's part of what you do when you sign off. And just because you've never looked at it or other auditors haven't looked at it, doesn't mean that I don't think you should. So, and other people can think what they want to think about it. These are not uncontroversial issues when they get to the House floor. But,
okay. I do have one question on the budget items. There was a request for $1.1 million for staff retention, and it doesn't look like the governor recommended that. That's something you'd like to have that he's not wanting to do, or did you guys decide not to go ahead with that?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we just took it out of our new budget request because we're assuming there's no money for staff retention. In fact, we're all looking at a cut. And so we took a look at the governor's recommendations. We decided, maybe we're not happy, but it made sense. And we've complete agreement now with the governor's recommendations. And he does support the increase of the out-of-process fund. So we will just deal with those cuts, I guess.
Okay. Very good. Do we have any last question before we move on to adjourning? Thank you for coming in this morning. We appreciate it, and we'll be in touch if we have more questions further. Just to let everyone know, our joint hearing with the Senate will be tomorrow. We are moving the time to 8:30 and the room to room 200. So members, don't come down here at 8:15. Go to room 200 at 8:30. And then a reminder, on February 15th, we have that evening hearing at 6:30 in room 200. Meeting's adjourned.